Welcome to Horror 101, a special series celebrating some of the most influential films from the horror genre. Tonight, the Saw series. We begin tonight with writer-director James Wan. James is the writer-director of the first Saw film in 2004 and has executive produced the remaining films in the series, leading up to Saw 3D, which opens Friday, October 29th. Film every year for the past 7 years. How? And this is the final installment. So, is it bittersweet for you?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. We never set out to make something that was going to last as long as it did, and it ended up becoming like this really big thing that ran away from us, and now we're going to finally be putting it to bed. I think that's not a bad thing.
So, made it feel like the right time to do that?
To be honest, really, I think just because I'm pumping one of these movies out every single year, it's really exhausting. Because the moment the film comes out, right, we would have to get ready like the script and have to make it, get into production and do it and get it ready by the next year. It's really taxing on the producers and the entire team. So I think people are tired and people feel like I think the audience have we get the impression the audience wants to move on from it, and that's fine, And so we wanted to wrap it up, and we felt like this is the final one to wrap it up with.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really the long, the short of the long answer is we are exhausted from it, and it's been a great ride, and it's time to call it quits.
Yeah. I'm curious. I want to talk about the origins of Saw with you as soon as he calls in. But as the series has progressed, and you've served as executive producer on many of the later installments, has there ever been a moment where satisfying the needs of the fans has kind of butted heads with what fulfills you creatively, where you think the series should go creatively?
Well, it has been a very tricky process, just because unlike a lot of other horror films out there, the Saw films actually have a very intricate plot line, I think it's like the only horror film out there that that can never be accused of not having like any kind of story behind it. It has story, it has plot points. If anything, I think to a fault that sometimes it's too much and it's kind of hard to keep track of it. So I think one of the hardest thing is really just like keeping track of where, timeline, where things fall, what has been done, what hasn't been done, what other story strands there are to explore. And, and when you're up to number 7, you've pretty much explored everything. And I think that's another reason, too, why we think, we've pretty much explored all the story there is to tell. And I think this is the perfect time to kind of stop now, because there isn't really anything else to tell. At least at this moment, we think we've got to the end, and we want to click quits for now. I think the producers, the actual producers, and the guys on the ground, doing the real tough groundwork and all that, have done a great job, keeping the fans satisfied, but at the same time trying to find something new and fresh to say. And that's definitely kudos to the producers, and kudos to the other two writers that came on board once Lee and myself were no longer as hands-on with it as we were. Lee wrote up to number 3. My involvement pretty much became less with 2, and they became less with 3. And that's only because, you know, I have my own movies to go and direct. So it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to, you know, still be in the mix when directing a movie basically takes up an entire year of your life, really.
Right.
And so it's been a tricky one. You know, it's definitely very bittersweet for me to kind of, you know, sometimes just have to kind of let it go and let other people take care of it.
Right.
To some degree.
What has your involvement been these past few years in the series? I mean, they obviously do they consult you about the directions that they want to take?
Well, they definitely do to some degree, and you know, it's gotten to the point where, you know, kind of like, I guess, kind of like what Carpenter ended up doing, which was, you know, he just kind of gave his blessing,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
as a pope would do, you know. You just kind of like, you know, it's got to the point where I feel like the producers are so much more, you know, so much more dulled into the world than I am at this point. So my main thing, and it was always my main thing with the sequels, was just to make sure that it did not become too ridiculously silly. That was the thing, and as you know, just the very nature of making sequels, especially sequels to horror film, is they tend to, you know, break into those boundaries, you know, break the boundaries and into territories where it becomes really outrageous. Fortunately for the Saw film, it's very outrageous to begin with, so it's not like if they got really crazy, it's not too far from what we had established in the first film. Now,
yeah.
having said that, I've always said the Saw sequels are definitely so much more, you know, out there and so much more removed than the first movie that Lee and I made, you know. And I think in a lot of ways, when people talk about the negativity of the Saw films, I like to put it down in some ways, they kind of lump the first film in it, and they talk about the first film in this sort of retroactive way,
mm-hmm.
where I like to remind people to go back and see the first one, that the first one really was a, you know, it's a pretty, by today's standards, a pretty low-key psychological thriller, you know, like there was very little traps, there was very little blood and guts, and a lot of that happened off-camera anyway. You didn't see a lot of this blood and guts stuff, and it really wasn't until the sequels that it kind of, you know, I guess, and the reputation of being the grandfather of, you know, I hate using this term, but the torture porn genre.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate that term because I never set out to make a movie like that, and I don't think my first film was like that. But it ended up falling into that bracket.
It absolutely was not your original film. I mean, your original film is a very tightly wound, claustrophobic thriller.
Right.
And
it was a thriller.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't a blood and guts horror film, so to speak. It was an outright thriller. You know, in the same way, you know, like, remember how, like, there was a period there before now the resurgence of respect for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Toby Hooper's version, right? But there was a period there in the late 80s or in the 80s where people were just so against it, saying, oh, how bad that film was and how, like, corruptive it was and how bloody and gory. And it wasn't until, like, recently, like in the late 90s or recently, right, that people look back at it and go, you know what, the first Texas Chainsaw that Toby Hooper directed is a masterpiece, is a horror
mm-hmm.
masterpiece, you know, of suspense and tension and scare, and it only had like one or two little sort of gory set pieces that that really stood out in people's mind, but the rest of the movie wasn't like that at all. You know,
I tell you, that's actually my all-time favorite horror film, original Chainsaw, and
right.
it's masterful in a way that Saw is masterful, in that in a lot of ways it deceives you into believing you're seeing a lot more than you're being shown. I mean, Hitchcock,
right.
that was Hitchcock's playbook.
Yeah,
the most graphic
exactly.
thing about Chainsaw Massacre is the title, the Texas
yes.
Chainsaw Massacre. You know,
yeah, exactly. That, no, you're right. That the title was what put it into the video nasty category.
Yes,
the title
yes.
really made a lot of people believe that it was a much more nastier film than it actually is. And I guess kudos to those guys for actually coming up with such a sensationalistic title that got a lot of people talking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
you know, when you're making these low-budget indie films, you know, you kind of need to stand out. And back then, that was their way of standing out. And, you know, and for us with the first Saw was, you know, finding, you know, like kind of cool ways to basically tell a story that people are pretty familiar with, which was, you know, a serial killer storyline, but try and find a fresh perspective to tell, you know, a story that we're all familiar with, but tell it in a different way.
Yeah, but you see this with all sequels. I mean,
yeah.
across genres, the more kind of sequels you make, you don't get more minimal in your approach. You raise the stakes. You up the ante.
Yes.
You up the murder quotient.
Exactly.
The action quotient. Yeah.
Right.
So I think
right.
it's
no,
just
you're,
a product
you're totally,
of that.
You're totally right. I mean, especially sequels to action films. Look how huge the action movies get with every sequel, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
look at
the Transformer films. You know, like they just get bigger and bigger with each one. You know, look at Die Hard. That's also another good example as well. How like each sequel. You know, like the first Die Hard was a freaking masterpiece, you know?
Mm-hmm,
and the second one is really cool, too, but the second one is bigger than the first one, and then the third one is bigger than the, you know, than the previous one, and the fourth one is bigger than the previous one, so, you know, and then you have your Star Wars sequels.
Yeah, exactly. It applies across the board. If Lee calls in, I'll pick up his line right away, but you must be a fan of the thriller horror genre. I mean, that must be of particular influence to you in your young life as you were planning to become a filmmaker, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I am. I'm. It's funny that you mention Hitchcock because I'm a big Hitchcock fan. You know, just like in the way Hitchcock inspired people like Steven Spielberg. So therefore, I'm a huge fan of Spielberg. You know, obviously Spielberg is the generation of filmmakers that I grew up with. You know, from Indiana Jones to E.T.
Mm-hmm.
to Jaws. I just think, you know, like I think of all the directors out there to take on the Spielberg, to take on the Hitchcock mantle, it was Steven Spielberg who did it best, I think. And Jaws, to me, is one of the finest thrillers ever made, you know, horror
yes.
thrillers ever made. And so, yes, I'm a big fan of, like, suspense, tension thrillers. You know, and of course, you know, like, I love the Italian Hitchcock, Dario Argento, you know, who obviously brings his sort of quirky sort of European quality to that sort of Hollywood style of thriller storytelling, and you know, and bring a very sort of visual quality to it. And so I'm a big fan of Argento and Mario Bava, and when Lee and I first set out to make our first, you know, small little indie movie, we wanted to infuse the film with a lot of these inspirations and movies that we love. But having said that, we wanted to do it our own way. And so,
yeah.
So therefore, you know, we created our own villain. We created our own sort of, you know, sort of iconic take on things, you know, like how do we hide the identity of the killer? Well, we hide the identity of the killer by having the killer speak through a puppet sitting on a tricycle. You know, which always seems really funny when I pitch it like that. But you know, for some reason, you know, it was just one of those things. You know, it was in the zeitgeist, and people just really caught on to it. They love that, and it's so funny that Billy the puppet became the face of the franchise.
Yes, yes. When we spoke with Brian De Palma, who's you know, an exceptional director of thrillers,
right.
they asked him, why do you work in that genre? And he said, well, because it's the most cinematic of the genres.
That's true.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
Visual, yeah.
Yes, I totally agree. And for directors that love to manipulate an audience, it is the best. It's the best genre, the horror thriller
mm-hmm.
genre, because you know, like you can literally, you know, you can make an audience laugh and scream and you know, just like go through all kinds of emotion. You know that that you don't really find with a lot of the other genre. I mean, you know, you can make a comedy, but usually I can tell you a lot of comedies don't scare you in the middle of the film, you know what I mean? Whereas horror films would scare the hell out of you, but then they'll kind of like lighten that mood a bit with something that makes you kind of like laugh to relieve that tension. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't find that in a lot of dramas or any other genre. But you do with the horror thriller genre because for a director, it's the most fun to play with because, you know, you compose your shots, you write your script in such a way, you craft, you know, everything is the perfect genre for a director who loves crafting the medium of filmmaking, you know,
yeah.
From visuals to sound designs to the way you interact, you block a scene to the way you move the camera to the way you cut a sequence and the way it plays out and the way, you know, like you get your actors to emote in the scene and stuff like that. So it's definitely one of my favorite genres to play in for that reason.
Yeah, it's a director's toy box, I would think, that genre. Tell me about you and Lee went to school together.
Yeah, Lee and I met in college, yes.
Okay, and this collaboration is obviously a very successful one. It's continued up till now. You guys have Insidious coming out, and we've actually spoke to Patrick Wilson a little bit about Insidious, and we're very excited about it. What clicked between the two of you? Why does that collaboration work so well?
It's so weird, you know, like, I haven't really worked in Hollywood for that long, but in the short amount of time that I've been here, you know, I have worked with a lot of different writers, and I've collaborated with a lot of different artists, and it's funny that Lee Whannell is definitely still one of the people, if not the top person, that I get along the best with when it comes to do with like ideas and concept and things that we have in common. When it comes to do with movies, we are so in sync.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we love the same things, we hate the same things, and what I really admire about Lee as a writer and as a concept guy as well is he never wants to settle for second best. He's always like trying to push me to come up with the best concept, best ideas, and I really admire that about him. And I find that when he does that, it really brings out the best in me as a director. And his writing is really strong. And, you know, he's a really great writer, Lee. And even though we generally, most of our movies, we don't have a lot of money to work with, but at the end of the day, we realize it's okay to not necessarily have, like, you know, the big summer tentpole kind of budget to work with, as long as we get to tell our stories and we get to tell, like, smart, you know, stories that people haven't really seen before. Lee and I really pride ourselves on coming up with things that are unique. And there's really only, like, what, 10, 12 stories out there that you basically just recycle again and again. I don't know which,
mm-hmm.
you know, great storyteller actually said that, right? And all you do is really repackaging it. And even then, I find Hollywood is kind of lazy sometimes. They don't really make the effort to try and find new ways to tell the story. And that's why, you know, like, I would read all these scripts, and to me, they're so boring. All these scripts, they all read the same. They all have the same sort of, they're so predictable. And yet the films that get made, are these films that Hollywood's kind of afraid to take chances on films that are unique because, you know, they go, well, we don't know if those films will be successful because it's not tried and true. It's not proven. It's not a formula. And I admire that about Whannell. So I think that's why he and I have mutual respect, and that I come up with all kinds of crazy concepts, and I throw it at Lee, and I go, hey Lee, what about a movie about this or a movie about that? And if he likes them, that's when I know I've come up with something really cool.
yeah.
You know,
but
just
you
because
guys
he holds such a high standard to what is good.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and you guys
so,
have ridden this roller coaster together. I mean this tremendous success of Saw. I mean, you guys got into it together, and you guys have risen to the top together. And I'm curious, you had
it's
no
idea. It's so funny that you see that, Jamie, because I still see myself as an underdog. I still see myself in many ways. Making it in the horror genre doesn't mean you're at the top of the game. I mean, you know, like maybe if you make it in the action or sci-fi or drama world, then you're at the top. Then you become like, you know, like your Chris Nolan or your, you know, or your James Cameron type, right? But making it to the top of the horror genre, just because of the way people kind of look down on this particular genre, I'm like, you know what? For me, it still feels like I'm still at the bottom and I'm climbing my way, you know, trying to make my way to the top. And I like that. I like being the underdog, despite the fact that that Lee and I have basically, you know, the biggest horror franchise out there.
Yes. I know exactly what you're talking about, because there's an element to horror that is kind of disreputable. And actually, some of the best horror movies. I mean, I think the horror genre almost works because of that. I mean, the best horror movies are underground. You know, they're done in that manner.
Don't you find it ironic that a lot of the movies that deals with social ill or make the loudest social commentaries are horror films.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, my God, I look at Texas Chainsaw and I look at movies like, you know, like Texas Chainsaw was such a commentary on the Vietnam War. I mean, my goodness, you know, and then you have Night of the Living Dead that was a commentary on the period that it came up with. And it's really interesting to hear people say that Source was the post-millennium type of, the first real post-millennium horror film. And it is somewhat of a reflection of the era and time that we now live in, you know, in the 2000, you know, like that is post 9/11, that is post terrorism, and it's a really different world that we live in. And I find the horror genre more than any other genre in particular that really ties itself to the era the film was made in, and I don't mean it dates itself. I just mean it's a big sort of social commentary about the era that it was made in. If that makes sense.
I think so too, and it works as a classic thriller, so it's timeless in that respect. But when you look at it, as you say, through the prism of 9/11, how far are we willing to go to survive?
Right.
You know.
Right.
Yeah. What are we willing to compromise here? Now, did that come into play as you were writing it? Was that just a byproduct of what you had ended up writing, or how did that?
You know, I think I wouldn't say we were consciously out there trying to make some kind of social statement, right? I would say that, but I definitely do believe in a big way, you know, like it did creep into our subconscious. I mean, it's hard for it not to be. Do you know what I mean? Especially when we wrote this story in the I think we came up with it like in the early 2000s. You know, the overall concept, or maybe even the late 90s, like just the seed of it, right? The concept we come with, but we sort of didn't really sort of like form it till like to Lee started writing the screenplay,
Well, horror movies are just ideally suited to make social commentary,
and the thing is, you can make those social commentaries and get away with it that you may not be able to do so in other genres. Maybe the only other genre is comedy, where you can make fun of someone and get away with it because that's funny, you know?
And you don't have to hit people over the head with it, unless your villain actually hits someone over the head.
Exactly.
What do you think the legacy of the series will be or is?
You know what's really incredible is I would get fan mails and I would get, you know, so like Facebook or MySpace messages from people, right? From especially like young adults and teenagers that loves this franchise. And the one thing that seems to be very common is how they would point out how they love that the movie deals with a villain who basically asks you to kind of take a look at your life and appreciate what you have and not take it for granted what you have, right? You know, like,
yeah.
You know, in a very 80s and 90s world where we kind of take everything for granted and it was very celebrity cultural driven, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to hear today's kids actually say to me that they really latch onto that idea, the concept of not taking what you have for granted and kind of like, you know, kind of be thankful of what you have. So so that has been a big part of the legacy that we never actually thought that people would latch onto, you know? You know, but they've definitely latched onto the subtext of the film, which is incredible. I mean, you know, obviously the stuff that people, that the fans love on the surface is, of course, you know, like the cool, fun traps, you know, the twisted mystery, you know, and the twist ending and you know, the sort of messed up nature of it all, which, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Saw really doesn't try to pretend to be anything other than, you know, it's a roller coaster ride, but in amongst all this stuff, you know, when Lee wrote the first script, he tries to make it more than just a throwaway horror film, you know, like any good writers would want to do, you know. So
like any great movie, it entertains as you're watching it, and it lingers when you leave it, you know. I mean, it gives you something
right.
more to chew on
to think about, right?
Yeah, it's about morality.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think the other big legacy that we cannot ignore as well is the fact that you know, Saw 3D, which is Saw number 7, right? It's about to come out. It comes out this weekend. What that legacy has done by having a new Saw movie come out every year is it's become such a big part of a staple, such a big part of, like, these kids growing up. It's a big part of their life. Do you know what I mean? Because, like, every Halloween, they've got a Saw film to look forward to. They know that there's a Saw movie coming. And that's why it's kind of sad, I guess, in the respect that, you know, I get a lot of Facebook messages from these fans saying that they find it sad in a nostalgic kind of way that, you know, the film is coming to an end because it's a big part of growing up for them, you know.
Yes.
Every year during Halloween, they've got that to look forward to, and now it's finishing. So I think that's the other legacy as well, you know, that there's a generation of kids years from now when they grow up, you know, like yeah, when they're in their late 20s or 30s or whatever, they will look back and they have such memory, whether it's fond memories or not, they have such memories of their teenage years growing up, right, off the Saw films.
Yes. I mean, it can play as integral a part in their adolescence as, you know, Jaws played for you when you were a kid.
Exactly. And the way Jaws scarred me for life about not wanting to jump into the ocean. Yeah.
Yes.
But the funniest thing is I would hear people go, oh, you know what? I got my first kiss while on a date to watch one of the Saw films. I would hear that a lot.
Wow.
To which my reply would be, you're welcome.
Well, I really appreciate your time, and I'm so sorry about the technical problems.
No worries.
Before I let you go, Insidious, your next film, is there a release date set up for that film?
No, not yet. Even though we did kind of get a version of the movie ready for the festival, which we did get it ready for Toronto. We premiered the film at the Toronto International Film Festival, which it was, you know, really well received. And I just got back recently from Spain because it played at Sitges. So even though you know, I got a version done, but I had to really rush, like any movies that are not quite finished yet, but they want to get it ready and get it into a festival, is you kind of like rush to try and get things done. So I'm actually still tweaking and still putting the finishing touches to it. You know, I like to think it's going to come out sometime next year because there's really only, 2 months left in this year, so it's definitely not coming out this year. And Lee and I are so excited about this film because we feel like we've finally made a movie that we think is, you know, after Saw, we went and made Dead Silence, and though Dead Silence is a fun movie, we felt like we didn't get to set up to make the scary film that we wanted. And I think in a lot of way, Insidious is that film. You know, it's when you're watching Insidious, you can tell our love for the genre. We wear our love for the genre on our sleeves with this film, but at the same time, we did what we did with Saw, which is we find a fresh perspective to what is essentially is a pretty stale, you know, sub-genre, which is the haunted house genre. I mean, my God, the haunted house movies have been done to death. And so, once again, you know, Lee and I like to think, you know, we found a fresh angle to it, and I think the fans really responded to it at Toronto.
Now we turn to the co-creator of the Saw series, Lee Whannell. Lee is the writer of Saw, Saw 2, and Saw 3, and played the role of Adam in the first Saw and Saw 3. And he's executive produced all the remaining films in the series as well.
Hello, Adam. This is Dr. Gordon. I want to play a game.
The Jigsaw Killer.
Paul, find the path for the razor wire.
Technically speaking, he's not really a murderer. He never killed anyone.
Dr. Gordon, your aim in this game is to kill Adam. If you do not, then Diana will die.
He finds ways for his victims to kill themselves.
Sick of people who don't appreciate their blessings. I've given you a life purpose.
Looks like our friend Jigsaw likes to book himself front row seats to his own sick being.
He doesn't want us to cut through our chains. He wants us to cut through our feet.
Most people are so ungrateful to be alive. Not anymore.
You are a drug addict. Do you think that is why he picked you?
He helped me. Don't believe Adam's lies.
Live or die. Make your choice.
Would you describe it as maybe bittersweet that the Saw film is filmed or coming to an end?
I would describe it as bittersweet. I think that's a good term. On the one hand, I feel artistically that going on for too long can make you a punchline. You know, as we've seen with films like Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and even non-horror films like Rocky, it can become a punchline if you keep flogging a dead horse. Not just flogging it, but, you know, punching it, electrifying it, and doing everything else to milk every last drop out of it. So I don't really want that to happen to the Saw films. Some people may say that ship has already sailed, but then on the other hand, It's kind of the end of an era for me. I mean, for James and I, Saw started in 2000, really. So it's really been the last decade of my life. That's definitely, a little time for reflection and a little bit melancholy in some ways, just seeing this era come to an end.
Right. Well, you mentioned James and James Wan, your creative partner, and y'all met in college and y'all have been collaborators on pretty much everything for the last decade. And so I'm curious, what is it about that collaboration? What is it that clicks between you two? Do you all have similar sensibilities, or do you all have different sensibilities and they complement each other?
That's an interesting question. I think that we were friends first. We met at film school and became friends, and I think that always helps. I certainly think it can't hurt. Although, maybe I have to retract that, because sometimes working together can hurt a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had that happen with me. But for some reason, James and I, we became friends, and we definitely had a shared sensibility in terms of our taste and the types of films that we talked about and got excited about. We were never in competition. You know, I think that James is a real encyclopedia when it comes to film. He's that guy who can name the best boy of a film. You may love it, and you may know who directed it, but he knows who was the grip on it, who served the catering. So he's kind of has this encyclopedic knowledge, and I was always really respectful of that and kind of in awe of it. I was always, you know, entertained hanging out with him and talking about these films. And then when we started working together, it just seemed like a natural fit because he wanted to be a director. That was his big goal. And I wasn't as focused on that. I thought that my strengths were more in writing, at least for the time being, so that we were never treading on each other's toes. And I just think that if you stay respectful of those boundaries, you can really have a thriving partnership. But it's an interesting thing to think about, you know. Beyond that, I think that we do have a shared sensibility when it comes to what we react to, you know, what makes it, you know. I've had a lot of other people talk about film ideas and maybe propose writing together, but I've noticed that a lot of times their ideas don't always gel with mine, and the things that they think are cool aren't exactly the things that I think are cool. And for some reason, with James and I, they seem to be in alignment a lot. So, yeah.
And, I'll ask you this as kind of a fun college question. Was there a movie or a director or a genre that first, you know, you and James kind of clicked, you know, bonded over?
Let me think. I would have to say it would be a split decision between the Evil Dead films, anything to do with Sam Raimi, and John Woo. Right when we were at film school, right in the mid-90s, is right when Hong Kong action films started to become popular. And it was seen as this big new thing. You know, now everybody has sort of plundered their Hong Kong sensibility so much that it seems like old hat. But if you cast your mind back to 1995, it was just starting to catch on. And that was amazing for me. I remember being really obsessed with the kinetic energy of those films. And because I was at film school, I was really obsessed with the camera, the way the camera moved. And both of those filmmakers, Sam Raimi and John Woo, have a very acrobatic, I'm trying to think of the word, just I don't want to say the word show-off, but they have a very showy style. The camera's moving and doing these crash zooms and slow motion. But I think James and I had a shared love of that. We could talk for hours about John Woo or Sam Raimi.
Right. And was this, you know, the inspiration of Saw, you know, this going into horror, what was the inspiration of that? Was it a matter of that was just kind of a fun thing, or was it also kind of the economics of it and that, you know, horror can be done relatively low budget without the necessity of, named actors when you want to break in?
Right. Definitely the latter. Although James and I loved horror films, and I think that even if, a rich uncle of ours had come to us and said, I'll give you $3 million to go off and make the film you want, we may have made a horror film anyway because we did love horror films.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think what you're talking about played a big role. When we finally realized after film school that making a film is quite hard, it seems obvious. But it seems like such an obvious thing, but I think when you're young and naive and you've just gotten out of film school, you have all these hopes and dreams. And we quickly found out that finding the money to make a film is really the ultimate obstacle. You might call it the only obstacle. You know, once you've gotten the money, you can go with God. But once we figured that out, we were like, okay, this film's going to have to be set in one room with two actors so that we can pay for it ourselves. So that was really what gave birth to Saw. It was truly a case of necessity being the mother of invention. You know, if you look at the storyline for Saw, it's two people chained up in a room. And that was all we could afford. And now, of course, we went on to make the film with a with a bigger budget than our than the $5,000 we thought we were going to be making it with, but it still really stuck to that low-budget template.
Right. And at what point, in whether it was in the making of that film or maybe when it became a hit or maybe it was during the sequel or whatever, but at what point did you realize that the character of Jigsaw, like, that you guys created a character that's going to be part of that, you know, horror hall of fame of, you know, psycho killers, if you will?
I think I started really noticing that when Saw began being mentioned in larger pop culture. You know, it's one thing to have horror film fans line up and say, hey, I loved your stuff, but it was another to hear Saw references cropping up on The Simpsons, South Park, and really the clincher for me, the ultimate moment for me was when we were mentioned on The Sopranos, which was my favorite show at the time.
Right.
I was over the moon. I couldn't believe that that Chris from The Sopranos mentioned Saw by name.
Right.
And I guess that was the moment where it clicked that I realized that Saw had become a part of the cultural conversation. And I think that's what horror villains need to do to enter that Hall of Fame you're talking about. You know, everybody knows who Freddy and Jason is. You know, maybe not my grandmother, but generally the mainstream public at large knows who they are and sort of uses them as a yardstick for horror iconography. Once I knew Jigsaw had entered the mainstream, I knew that we were going to be iconic in some way.
Right. And you were involved, at some level up until, you know, all the way through part three. And so I'm curious, what has been your role of your involvement since then? Obviously, you guys have come back for this final one, but in the interim, were you all just kind of, you know, consultants or gave your blessings, or did y'all ever, you know, try to put more input into those latter sequels and maybe, you know, other people decided to go another way but now you decided to get more involved? I'm just curious how's your relationship been with these films in the later years?
It's been an interesting relationship. It's been involved but separate, if that makes sense. We've kept in contact, obviously, with the producers and the filmmakers, and we definitely have a say, and we can, you know, we go and watch a cut of a film each year, but we're not as involved as you might think. We definitely stepped away from the sequels. We had our own films that we were working on. And I guess we trusted in our collaborators, like Oren and Mark. They've been through the trenches, and you know, Jason Constantine from Lionsgate. All these people that have worked with the franchise, we trust them, and we let them go and make the films they wanted to make. And you know, thankfully, they've stuck to the template that we set, and they haven't done anything that's made us cringe. So we've been happy to sort of step away and just let them go.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a point of you guys, you know, wanting, you know, having an idea of what was, you know, what would be good for a certain instance versus what other people might have thought, you know, the fans wanted? You know, there's always that clash between what the creative people want for the series to be, and then for other people saying, well, that's good, but the fans really want this. And
yeah, I think it's been interesting watching Saw develop. The first Saw film, James and I really saw it as like a locked room thriller. We weren't trying to come up with a horror franchise. We were just trying to make a film, and we loved this story. And for us, funnily enough, the juice of the story, the thing that made us excited, was the two guys stuck in the room in that first movie. We knew we had a great ending, and we loved the idea of a film opening with two guys waking up and not knowing where they were. We thought that was really compelling. Now, of course, you know, when I was writing the screenplay and I invented the character of Jigsaw, I really invented him as a function of that story. For instance, I knew that there was two guys stuck in a room, but I had to figure out who put them there.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like the character of Jigsaw came first, and then we thought, okay, what's the situation? Oh, okay, he's chained two people up in this bathroom. It was definitely the situation first, then the character, and I had to sort of invent the character to fill in the blanks. So what was interesting when the film came out was that you talk about the fans latching on to certain elements. I do think that fans and audiences make films their own.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a Cameron Crowe quote about Jerry Maguire. He wrote that film and he had deliberately tried to invent this phrase for Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character. And when the movie came out, the quote that the audience grabbed the hold of was, "Show me the money," which he had never thought of that as the big quote of the movie. Now everybody identifies that quote. And so I guess that's an example of the audiences telling Cameron Crowe what was memorable. You can't tell an audience what they'll like. They pick their own moments. I guess that's the great cinematic democracy. And so what happened with Saw was that one thing they really grabbed a hold of, which was a secondary element in the first film, was the traps. I mean, if you think about it, the first Saw film, we only saw the traps very briefly in flashback, and it was more to help set up this character. The sequels have gone on to make the traps and the character of Jigsaw the guts of the series. And that's been interesting to watch. It speaks to what you're saying about the creators wanting the franchise to go one way and then the fans saying, no, no, no. And so, you know, I think that the sequels have become increasingly more violent, much more violent than the original, and they've become much more about the traps and how complicated they are. And that's fine. You know, I don't have a problem with that. But it's interesting. It's not what the first film was about. So that's definitely been interesting.
Well, two more questions. One, bringing it all home to Saw 7, you know, this final Saw, and it's in 3D. And so how do you feel about this final installment? How do you feel about it?
I like it. I really do like it. I think it's a good way to close out this. I really see the series as being two trilogies. You've got the first three films, and then you've got the second trilogy, 4, 5, and 6. And in the second trilogy, which was written by different writers, they came up with their own characters and their own world. And I sort of think that this sequel kind of gives some closure and some finality to both trilogies.
Mm-hmm.
It references the first trilogy of films and the characters James and I created. And it also obviously wraps up some loose ends from the second trilogy. So it's kind of, you know, a seventh film is kind of a nice number to give balance to both of them. And I also think the 3D is a fun gimmick too.
And the last question related to Saw, I'll ask you, have you and James, have you and Mr. Wan, are you all okay now? I mean, do you all realize that from here on out that, you know, every Halloween, you know, these films are going to be brought up, and you know, horror conventions and genre conventions. You know, you guys forever now are going to be a part of that apparatus of film culture.
Well, yeah, it's difficult to comprehend things like that on a moment to moment basis. You know, because I'm just living my life and doing my thing like everyone else. But every now and again, I'll be driving down the street, usually during Halloween time, like you said, and I'll look up and see the Jigsaw puppet's face on a billboard.
Mm-hmm.
And it just hits me that this is really something that isn't going to go away. It's part of the cultural conversation now, and it's really amazing. I'm really thankful for it and kind of humbled by it, because something that James and I created in the suburbs of Melbourne, you know, all the way on the other side of the world, has resonated with Americans and with people across the world, in Europe and everywhere. That's pretty incredible. I mean, it's hard to... I guess it's the same feeling a musician gets when they write a song in their basement just on an acoustic guitar, and then it goes on to become a number one hit and something that people love. It's kind of hard to comprehend that something you do in private could connect with a world audience, and I'll always be thankful for that and be humbled by it.
And you mentioned the Jigsaw puppet, you know, pops up at Halloween. I'm curious, over the years, has there been a, like, you know, offers or, you know, maybe what was the craziest offer of a Jigsaw tie-in? You know, I don't know, maybe, were there ever, you know, did anyone ever propose, you know, Jigsaw condoms or something? Anything?
I never, maybe that question might be better asked of the Lionsgate marketing and merchandising department, but no one's actually proposed anything to me directly, although I can say that I did think it was nuts when the Jigsaw roller coaster opened in, there's a theme park in England, apparently. I think it's just out an hour outside London. There's a theme park with a roller coaster where you get strapped in and you are subjected to a Jigsaw ride. I've never been on it. Apparently you hear the voice and you hear Tobin's voice tell you that you only have, you know, minutes to live. That's definitely crazy to think that that somewhere out there on the other side of the world there's, you know, British teenagers are strapping themselves into a roller coaster, again, because of something that James and I invented years ago back in Melbourne. But I wish I could think of a better answer. I will say this. One of the best moments ever for me, I used to collect toys. When I was in Melbourne, I would collect the horror movie toys that they usually sell at comic book stores.
Right.
And, you know, I had, you know, Ash from Evil Dead and Freddy and Jason, Michael Myers and Leatherface. I sort of spent my 20s collecting these toys. So one of the greatest moments for me was seeing the Jigsaw toy come out. Some company somewhere released a Jigsaw figurine, and I bought a few of them, and I was just so chuffed. I couldn't believe that was good closure for me. It's like, right, I finally made it. A character that James and I created has its own line of toys.
Well, and to bring it into the future, I'll ask you, what can you tell us? I know the film has just been bought, and so they're still planning out the market and so forth. So what can you tell us about you and James's next film, Insidious? I know it's played at festivals and it's gotten positive reviews and positive responses. So what can you tell us about Insidious?
Insidious is really James and I's take on the Haunted House film. I mean, what we generally like to do and what we try to do with Saw is take something that maybe you think you've seen before and give it a new, unique twist. I mean, no matter what you think of Saw, whether you love it or you hate it, I definitely think there's some pretty bizarre, unique elements. Maybe they don't seem so bizarre anymore because they're so ubiquitous. Like you said, the Jigsaw puppet, you've seen it enough that you take it for granted now. But if you think back, that's pretty bizarre to have a killer running around who speaks through this bizarre ventriloquist puppet that rides around on a trike. I do like that James and I seem to come up with these things that are pretty out there. I mean, a lot of people have told us that, and that's why they're probably polarizing, you know. We don't like to sit in the middle ground. We like to do this unique stuff. And so I would say that Insidious, if you can imagine the thoughts that went into creating a sinister puppet on a tricycle, imagine that same thought process applied to the haunted house genre.
Mm-hmm.
And, we screened at Toronto, and the film was bought by Sony. And we've been chatting with him. We're so excited about it. It's kind of good timing that this era of Saw is coming to a close, and hopefully we're going to be able to release a new film, a new horror film, and have people love it. I mean, we should be so lucky that people connect with Insidious as much as they have with Saw. But we're definitely trying to say, hey, we're still here, and we've got... We're not one-trick ponies. We've got more ideas up our sleeve.
Right. And any idea on the release? Is this going to be spring, or is this going to be held towards, you know, summer or Halloween next year?
I actually don't know. They haven't even hinted at that. The first thing they wanted to do was sort of just talk about, you know, testing the film. And there's a whole process that a studio has to go through before they decide on a release date. So I really have no idea. I'll be as surprised as you are when they finally talk about when they're going to release the film. But I'm sure it'll be sometime next year. I would be certain of that. And I'm really excited about it. I mean, I've had film experiences in the past, say with Dead Silence, where I felt like the end product was compromised and I wasn't that excited about the release of the film, just because I felt like it's not the film that we set out to make. This is not that. This is James and I unleashed.